Journey Church is a community and movement, a fellowship of discovery. We desire to love well and serve often, while together we explore the adventurous love story of Jesus.
Let me jump right in this morning. If you have your Bibles, we're in Matthew chapter 18. So if you've got a paper version, electronic version, or any other version that is just out these days where you can capture the Bible that I may be unaware of, that wouldn't surprise me. Go ahead and grab that. And Matthew chapter 18, I'll start in verse 2. It says, "He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And he said, 'Truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. Therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me.'" How many of you, when you open up the memory banks, if you take it way back, and this could be scary for you, because some of you, if we open up the memory banks of childhood, it freaks you out a little bit, and you're going, "Well, let's move quickly through this part because I want to skip that season of my life." But for others, like, go there with me. You open up the memory banks of your childhood, and you're just flooded with sweet memories. Yeah, anybody? And of course, there's a lot of the stuff to filter through. There's some weeds that got to be pulled if we're going to work in that garden for a little bit. But for the most part, you go in there and you're just going, "Oh man, that takes me back to this," or "takes me back to that," or "Oh gosh, I remember that. I remember that time when me and so and so were. Oh, that was amazing. I got to call them." And for me, it certainly does that. I don't entirely know why, but for some reason, I can recall my childhood better than I could recall what happened last year. I just can. I hope someone can relate to that, and that's not like something I need to get checked out. But I can remember my childhood because I love some of the memories that I have of me playing as a child. And I was talking to my mom on the phone recently, just like, "Mom, do you remember this? Do you remember this?" And she's like, "Yeah, yeah. Do you remember that?" "No, wait, what? 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 What'd you do? Oh my goodness, I didn't know about, you know." But I go all the way back. If I go back to elementary school, there was something for me about just going out and playing with the other kids on the street. And I remember, "Hey mom, I'm gonna go play." "Well, what are you gonna do?" "Well, I'm gonna go play on the street." "All right, but what are you gonna do?" I'm gonna play. I don't know how to answer the question. "I'm gonna go play on the street." "All right, go." And then I didn't realize, but I actually knew what play was, but I only had the picture of the experience of it. I couldn't give her a definition. I couldn't pinpoint the thing. So, "Mom, this is what I'm going to do. At 8:35, I'm going to do this. At 8:37, I'm going to put my rollerblades on. At 8:38, I'm going to go play, and whatever happens, happens." It was completely spontaneous. Not a single bit of it was scripted or scheduled. Not any of it was really routine, because it was always a new, at least for me, it was a new adventure every time I went outside. I remember one time my buddy Tony, see, I got to be careful here because I'll just keep going. We'll be here for hours. But I remember my buddy Tony came over one time, and I was that kid, and there's a piece of me that still is. You're going to be like, "My kids are never hanging out with you." I love fireworks. I just love fireworks. And in Oregon, where I grew up, we didn't have the fireworks that you could like send up in the air and they'd explode and you were like, "Oh, that is awesome." We had the dinky little fireworks that sat on the ground and the law so they couldn't shoot 6 feet up in the air. Like, who even sells those things? It should be embarrassing, right? Well, I'm thinking there's got to be a way. These things are really fascinating. And so I found out the little ground blooms you light up and they spin around really fast. They go, which we thought was cool. And they make really bright colors and that's it. Like, people like to make money off that stuff. We found out that if we could drill a hole through the side of the thing, that sucker would go 30 feet in the air. Straight up in the air. And so sure enough, we got them. We line them up. And we just, and it's like, you know, when you're a kid, it's what your mom's like, "Run!" We're gonna blow the street up, and sure enough, one just—I mean, they would go flying everywhere. Next thing I know, the whole street is lined with the City of Salem Fire Department. We're burning the bushes down of all the neighbors. Completely true. We're burning the bushes down. we're trying to make up stories like, oh no, like it was just one of those little ground blooms. Like it jumped the curb, right? I still do that. Minus hopefully burning the bushes down. And I remember, moved forward a few years, I had a buddy, Jason, who lived on the street. And man, I have so many memories of just being a child at play with Jason. And I got in a lot of trouble too, but a lot of really fantastic memories. I remember Jason would come over and he'd knock on my door and he'd say, it's time. And I'd be like, what do you mean it's time? I'd look out, he had his German Shepherd on the leash. I'd be like, it's time. So I'd go back in the garage. I'd get my rollerblades. Remember those? You buy them at the antique store nowadays. I'd get my rollerblades out of the garage, buckle those things on, and I'd say, Mom, I'm gonna go skate down the street with Jason. Okay, go skate down the street. And I'd go out there and we'd get on the grass where you didn't roll, and Jason would tie about a 20-foot rope onto the leash of his dog. And I'd, okay, here we go, man. Jump out in the street, whip that dog, and we would just go screaming down the road. And we'd just do it back and forth all day. That was before PETA was really big. Didn't have to worry about those kinds of things. And then one of my favorites is we would go out and we would play ninja, right? Right? We'd go out and play ninja, like we'd get all decked out in the black. We'd have just the eyes showing. We'd have like the fake swords and stuff. And we would literally, like people would be walking, doing their exercise down the sidewalk. And we'd be like stealth mode and up right behind them, like seeing how close we could get without them seeing us, like see if we could like cut the ankles off, but then they wouldn't even know it happened, right? And we'd jump into the trees and all this stuff. And then one night the cops came over and knocked on the door. And I could hear Mom open the door and, oh, it's Officer So-and-so, Salem Police Department. We just got a lot of calls from your neighborhood just about some kids just jumping fences through everyone's backyard in the street and hiding around, sneaking in, hiding in the back of their trunks and riding the bed of their truck down the street. And we just heard, we just got a tip, we should probably check out this address. And my mom, I hear her out there just going to work for me. No? Sorry, officer, I can't help you. I mean, I'll keep my eyes open for him. And she'd close the door, and I'd be like, whew. And next mom come around the corner, I'd be like, hey, Mom. She'd be like, you're grounded. You are grounded. Mom, I was going to stay the night at Jason's house. You are not staying the night. I know exactly what you're doing out there with Jason. Anyway, so some fantastic memory. And I kid you not, we could just keep walking it down, and it wouldn't make much of a message. But I remember I carried that sense of play into middle school. I remember somehow me and my buddy Kent convinced my mom, catch this, because this is really profound. We convinced my mom to take us TPing. I know it's illegal here. It probably was there too, but we were kids, right? So don't judge. And we would roll people's house. But my mom drove us, and she drove us to Walmart. We took the allowance, bought 100 rolls of toilet paper. She thought it was awesome. And we're cruising the streets. She's helping us pick out the biggest tree to roll in town. I was like, what? But I remember those friendships led into just a great time getting into snowboarding and mountain biking and all sorts of things. And the most beautiful part of it is I never even knew that it had a purpose in my life. It was simply done just because it was and it could be. And it was done for just the simplicity of enjoying it. That was the only purpose it served. It was the greatest thing on the planet. It was never, despite what my parents thought, it was never, well, he's going to do his chores, he's going to do his homework, and that was the case, but that was never the intent. Like, I didn't do my chores so that I could accomplish finishing the chores and feel like I achieved some. Like, I did the chores so I could get out the door and go ride rollerblades behind a German Shepherd. Like, in seventh grade, I wasn't doing my homework so that when I did my homework, it wasn't so that I could do my homework and increase my GPA because I had college on the mind. No, it was like, finish this so I could get out the door and go play it and go have some fun. That moment of my life as a child was the most important thing that mattered above anything else. And I carried that through high school. I carried that on into college. I had a ton of fun in college. This probably explains why it took me 3 years longer than average to get my undergrad. We'll skip past, just skip past that part. The pressures of life, I would say, really started to hit me in my 20s. Many of us, we resonate with that. But I would say that play was still at its finest for me. And now just scraping into the 30s, I don't know entirely what my 30s are going to look like. I'm just at the front end of them, but I really think that maybe if the pattern continues, I'll have a lot of fun, and play will certainly be a healthy piece of a healthy lifestyle for me. And beyond that, beyond the age that I've experienced this issue with, I don't have a lot of experience, obviously, but I've made some observations that, for some people, and I don't know how many people, I don't want to make big generalizations, but it's just based on the culture, the society that we live in. For some people, play can become less and less of a theme in life. And it can start to become crowded out by the overwhelming volume of things that become necessities. And a little bit of this comes in, and a little bit of that comes in, and all of a sudden, we forget that at one point in life, we were a child at play. And then we start saying things like, well, it's time for you to grow up, or stop acting like a child, right? And we start to find ourselves with a little bit of a play deficit in life without even realizing it. And then life's new rhythm and theme become productivity, while playful activity is only experienced so long as it fits on the calendar, or it fits in the schedule, or it fits in the routine, that it's safe, that it's controllable, that you can put walls around it, you can scale it, you can predict it, but then I would submit it ceases to be play. Love this. Mark Buchanan wrote an incredible book. Really, the book's about Sabbath. It's called The Rest of God. And he says, if there's one God of the age, one God of the age that Christians especially pay homage to, it's the God of utility. As a tribe, we're deeply, devoutly utilitarian. Everything we do, we seek to justify on the grounds of its usefulness. But play is subversive, really. It subverts business as usual. It subverts necessity. It subverts utility. It subverts all the chronos-driven, taskmaster-supervised, legalism-steeped activities that mark out most of our lives, that make us oh so useful, but bland and sullen in our usefulness. This reminds me of a time, and again, gosh, there's 100 stories that could fit here, but reminds me of a time that we were in Nicaragua, and we were in a community center painting inside a room with highly chemical-infused paints inside a room at 120 degrees. You know what that does to you? You know how they say, like, hey, don't breathe in the paint? So it was wild, all right? It was really wild. And then all of a sudden, I mean, everyone is sweating profusely, trying to just like see clearly, like remember people's names and stuff. And all of a sudden, the most glorious sound reaches our ears. And it's the sound of raindrops beating down on the roof. And we hear the rain coming, and we're just like, oh, it's raining. Whose idea was it to paint? So we go stand outside, and we're like, it's raining. And we'd go outside like you think we'd never seen water for 100 years. And it's just like, oh, it's right. Just keep raining. And we just like, Lord, just keep letting it rain. And he did. He did. He heard us. And oh, I tell you what, it was a thunderstorm of epic proportions. The rain was coming down hard. There were puddles filling in the cracks in the concrete. There were holes that they were mixing concrete for this project. And those were filling up with rain. And all of a sudden, we were just like, we got to do it. We got to do it. So here we go. And all like 30 of us, we're just running in the rain, dancing, singing, laughing. Like literally, I'm not even making this up. Like on the ground, just like barrel rolling through the puddles. Like full body, just clearing that puddle right on out. And it was amazing. All of time, anything productive, any other priorities, anything there was to accomplish, it all stopped and stood still for that moment where we could be childlike and roll in the puddles. Now, there was another group there with us that was also painting, missionary group. And I want to be careful here because I really do have kind things to say. And so this story could sound and paint a picture that maybe many of us are familiar with. But while we're playing out in the rain, this other group is standing, crouched, huddled underneath the, just like as if it was like acid pouring down from the sky, right? And I remember just one of my little like excursions around the whole like rainy field thing. I hear the leader of their group. We a whole bunch of us heard her just going, "Oh my goodness, I can't believe they would let those kids play in the rain like that." And I'm thinking, well, it's kind of hard to stop them when you started it, right? So at this point, I'm fully committed, and it didn't really matter. I just kept going, but I could see how for her, she's going, well, this is obnoxious. This is completely obscene. They're getting dirty. They're making noise, and all productivity just completely came to a halt because of this act. I just, where are their leaders? Woo! You know, there they are, there they were, right? And the simplicity that play subverts business as usual. In so many ways, it truly does stop time. It takes us away from the legalistic, steeped activities and attitudes that we become so used to, so accustomed to, in fact, almost become, and I would say almost especially because many of us are Christians, it almost would seem like it becomes expected of us that you need to now carry with you a certain maturity so that the world wouldn't think lowly of us. That if you go and play, the obnoxiousness of such a thing would turn people away from the goodness of God. Wow. And now, to be fair, play is really hard to define because it looks drastically different for everybody. And to be fair, it's not that the leader of this trip didn't know how to play. She could actually have a very fantastic rhythm of play in her life. It's just that if we're not careful, we can stop being respectful. We can miss what it looks like to appreciate what play looks like for other people, even if what play looks like for them is different than what play looks like for us. Catch that. Play's gonna look wildly different to a 5-year-old than it's gonna look to a 55-year-old. Fair? Fair. For some people, play might mean jumping out of planes, playing basketball, dancing awesomely, and singing viciously at the top of the lungs in the car and the shower, but not at the same time, right? To other people, play might mean going out for a cup of coffee, tilling the soil in the garden, playing Scrabble and Uno, and then following it up with a nice tea and biscuit, right? And it wouldn't be fair to say that those people don't experience play as much as these people experience play, because what it is for them is it's simply the pleasure of doing it. And that for them, that stops time, creates rest, and rejuvenates the soul just as much as anybody else who would go play basketball, sing aggressively, and run and play in the rain and not even care about it. So it's hard. It's hard to nail down what play is, but in general, I think most people would agree that play is time well spent doing something for no reason other than the sheer pleasure of doing it. That time, play is time well spent doing something, you fill in the blanks, for no other reason than the sheer pleasure of doing it. Beyond enjoyment, it's done purposefully for its uselessness. And from that come this whole basket of beautiful things. From it come joy. From it come freedom. From it come this vulnerability. And from the vulnerability comes the opportunity to be known. Being known, from that comes the opportunity to be loved. With community is formed, restoration is seen, experienced. And I don't think it's too much of a stretch to say that when play is at its finest and when it's healthy, we get a glimpse of what it's like to experience creation. And we get a taste for worship. I'm gonna come back to that. But who understands the sheer pleasure of play better than absolutely anyone else on the planet? A child. Nobody understands play, unfabricated, purposeless, useless, glorious play, better than a child. And so we return to Matthew 18. And I'll start us in verse 1. But let me paint a picture for the setup here, because really what Jesus is about to say comes as a rebuke to people who failed to see clearly the heart of a child. And so here's Jesus with his disciples. Gosh, everything we see in the Gospels is Jesus with the disciples. I think there's a beautiful picture of discipleship. But here's Jesus with the disciples, and they're up in the Sea of Galilee. They're up in a booming fishing town, small little town called Capernaum on the Sea of Galilee. And they're walking around. As the story is recalled in Mark, we see that they're just walking through town. I get the picture of them skipping rocks by the lake, just kind of leisurely moving about, because what's happening is the disciples are in a little bit of a conversation. There's a good bit of discussion centered around who is the greatest in the kingdom. And I get this picture, this kind of this bantering back and forth. Like if you're married, it'd almost be like as if you were trying to choose where to go to dinner. And I really hope that's not just me, because it made me feel really bad if it was. But it's just this undecided, well, I think this. Well, I don't know. You could be onto something there, but I'm thinking this. And going back and forth, who is the greatest in the kingdom? And I mean, quite honestly, if they're the ones walking literally in this moment in the footsteps of Jesus going, well, I'll tell you what, man, I don't know. I got a hunch that it's Peter. I mean, for crying out loud, Jesus is into the whole fishing thing. Peter was the fisherman. They got something in common, but I don't know. Then there's John. And we all know how Jesus feels about John. He's quite a guy. He's pretty highly regarded in Jesus. So maybe Jesus, like if we were to ask Jesus, who's the greatest in the kingdom? He would go, oh, it's probably John. Or maybe it's his brother-in-law. And then I could just see him like, well, it's certainly not Matthew. He was sitting at the tax booth. We don't even know why the dude's here, right? But what if it's, and so finally then Jesus overhears the conversation and he's going, well, I'm going to give him an opportunity to tell me what I already know. And so picture being though, he turns around. So what are you guys in a little bit of a conundrum about? Hey, Peter, you want to respond to that? I think John actually, thanks for asking, but John was actually, you know what? He didn't like Matthew probably. Why don't you just have Matthew? Why don't you tell him what's up? All right. So here we are. Anyway, we pick it up in verse 1. At the time, the disciples came to Jesus and asked, who then is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? And again, verse 2. He called a little child to him and placed the child among them. And I think we got to stop and we got to see, like, he's communicating something by this. I think we get the picture that little children were very irritating to the disciples. They weren't like, oh, kids. They were like, what's that? And why is it coming near to Jesus? Right, and we get this picture, another story in Mark, where people would bring their children to Jesus and he would pray over them and bless them. And literally the disciples in that moment are saying, what are you people doing? Why is this happening? No. And then, of course, Jesus, there's a little bit of a rebuke and some correction there. And he explains his blessing over children and he goes into it, much like he does here. So here Jesus is, he's communicating something. Who's the greatest in the kingdom of heaven? Child, come here. Come here. And placed the child among them. Verse 3. And he said, truly I tell you, unless you change and become like little children, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven. That's a pretty strong statement. He's talking to grown men, saying, you, grown man, you who have a lot of experience in life, you who have walked through a lot, you who have a lot going on in your story, it's been quite a journey, and you're here now as a result of everything that's landed on you. Unless you can hit rewind, go back to what it was like to be a child, you will not enter the kingdom of heaven. Unless you can change and become this child, there's not a chance. And I don't think he was referring to maturity. I don't think Jesus was saying, unless you can just eat your food all sloppy, throw things against the wall, and stomp out of the room, you will enter the kingdom of heaven. That's not what he's saying. I think he's saying, you, unless you can take on the innocence, the humility, the vulnerability, and the character, not the maturity, but the character of this child, surely you won't see the kingdom of heaven. He says, therefore, whoever takes the lowly position of this child is the greatest in the kingdom of heaven. And whoever welcomes one such child in my name welcomes me. And then, as if he didn't already make a point, he kind of goes Jack Bauer on him. And verse 6, he says, if anyone causes one of these little ones, those who believe in me, to stumble, it would be better for them to have a large millstone hung around their neck and to be drowned in the depths of the sea. Now, I have to confess that while this subject of play is something that I'm deeply passionate about, at the same time, it's something that I'm completely confused by. It's something that I definitely don't have figured out, that I may not even be close to having it figured out. In fact, at the end of the day, I could have this whole thing wrong. But it comes from a deep place of conviction for me. And so I choose to press into it. When we look through the pages of the Bible, quite honestly, we aren't going to see very much on the meaning and purpose of play. We're just not. That passage in Matthew is not primarily in reference to the character of a child as seen through moments of play. That passage in Matthew is about how the kingdom is found by those who can mirror the humility and innocence and vulnerability of a child. Back to this place of conviction, when we've gone to Nicaragua to love on that community by playing with the kids, we see that play isn't just about innocence, vulnerability, and humility. It is those things, but it's so much more than those things. It's about the joy that comes from it. It's about the laughter. We walk back to this list that I already said. It's about the joy. It's about the laughter. It's about the community that's being formed. It's about the restoration that's being worked out in these kids, but as it's worked out through them, as it's worked out in their families, as it's worked out in their families through the church and through the church into the entire community. It's about the hugs and the kisses. It's about the smiles. It's about the hellos and the goodbyes and what's really being said when those words are exchanged. So, why tiptoe into a passage about the innocence, humility, and vulnerability of a child when what we're really talking about is the joy-filling, life-giving, community-forming, restorative process of such a thing called play? When there's countless narratives and passages and beautiful stories that paint a picture of all those things, and we choose this one to look at play. And it's because I think that if we're not careful, we will too soon stop seeing God's design for us through the eyes of a child. Just catch that. If we're not careful, we will too soon stop seeing the beautiful design that God has through us as seen through the eyes of a child. And when that happens, we lose our glimpse of eternity. And when that happens, we cease to worship God. Buchanan says, play hence at a world beyond us. It carries a rumor of eternity. News from a kingdom where chronos and utility are no more welcome than death and Hades and the ancient serpent. When we play, we nudge the border of forever. When we play, we get a glimpse of eternity. We get a glimpse of the kingdom. We get to taste a piece of heaven. When we play. You've likely heard Jamie talk about living out our God-designed life and discovering and living out whatever it is that God has designed for us, his calling on our life. The way that he's wired us is not an accident. The way that he's designed each piece of our personality, our identity, our being, and the way that we have the ability to do certain things that other people don't have the ability to do, how he's designed us to use those things in the kingdom, and therefore that we would live out our God-designed life. The beautiful thing about the God-designed life is that it's the God-designed life. It's not the Aaron-designed life. The end, the aim, the motivation of living out this life that God has designed me for, it's not so that I could become more successful. It's not that I could become more productive or have more awareness. See, those things could happen. Those things could very well be byproduct of that. But the motivation for me living out my God-designed life is nothing more designed for worship. It's designed for worship. It's designed so that when I am living in who he has created me to be, he is worshiped, he is prayed. Puts a smile on his face, it's music to his ears. I love this. John 15, verse 8. I read it from the Amplified Version. I get kind of geeked out about it because it puts cool things in quotation marks that help me understand things. It says, when you bear or you produce much fruit, my Father is honored and glorified, and you show and prove yourselves to be true followers of mine. I have loved you. And gosh, listen for the gospel in this. Just as a side note, we're not going into that, but just listen for the redemptive pieces here. I have loved you as the Father has loved me. Abide in my love. Continue in his love with me. I want to be with you. I want to be in relationship with you. Let's do this together. If you keep my commandments, if you continue to obey my instructions, you will abide in my love and live on in it, just as I have obeyed my Father's commandments and live on in his love. I have told you these things. Catch this. I have told you these things that my joy and my delight may be in you, and that your joy and gladness may be of full measure and complete. And not only that, overflowing. This is like saying when you produce much fruit, and let's take joy, you peek into the fruit of the Spirit, joy is certainly one of them. When you produce fruit, when you bear much fruit, and when you are in rhythm with the design that I have for you, when you are in obedience with my perfect plan for your life, God is worshiped and glorified. In the 1600s, there was this old catechism. There was this meeting, and there were some documents published, and it became known as the Westminster Catechism. There were various versions of it, and one of the things that's most popular is this question that it answers. The Westminster Catechism has a question, and the question is, what is the chief end of man? What is the chief end of man? And its response is, the chief end of man is to glorify God by enjoying him forever. That's the purpose of life. That's the sole reason for the existence of human beings, is to glorify God by enjoying him forever. And then John Piper comes along, and fantastic pastor and writer and preacher, and he latched onto that, kind of flipped it around, wrote 6 books about the same thing, and they're good, but there's just a lot of information on this piece. And he recoins it, and he says it this way. So that must mean then that God, he says, God is most glorified in us when we are most satisfied in him. That God is most glorified. He is the happiest. The smile could not be bigger. He could not be looked down on his creation and go, "Oh, this is good." No more than when we find satisfaction in him. Imagine what that satisfaction might look like if you were a child. Imagine what it would look like if you could hit rewind as a grown-up and take on the character of a child and go, "Oh, to be satisfied, to enjoy with joy him." And on this, he says, Piper says, "Perhaps you see what drives me to be radical about this. If it is true that God has most glorified us when we are most satisfied in him, then look at what is at stake. If I say that pursuing joy is not essential, I am saying that glorifying God is not essential. You throw out joy, you throw out God. You throw out God, you throw out joy. But if glorifying God is ultimately important, then pursuing the satisfaction that displays his glory is ultimately important." And this is where I come to submit that all of play is an opportunity to make worship to God. And if all of life is worship, if all of life is worship, if we really exist to bring glory to God by enjoying him, then I'm convinced that all play in this life is a rehearsal for what is going to be the greatest act of play in human existence. And therefore, the greatest moment of worship that God would ever hear. And if that's the case, I don't want to miss rehearsal. I don't want to miss my opportunity to play. I don't want to miss my opportunity to sing and dance and run in the rain, because there's absolutely no reason for doing it other than simply doing it and believe that God would look down on his child, me, in that moment with a smile and say, "This is good." Arguably, quite possibly one of the greatest children books published, The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe. And for those of you who are, by C.S. Lewis, but for those of you who are familiar with it, it really serves as a metaphor for the hero of our story and what it looks like to be in relationship with him and to experience the hero of the story, our great friend and leader of relationship and love, to make what quite possibly becomes the greatest sacrifice that could ever exist in our minds and our hearts and in history, only to come back and say, "This relationship meant more to me. That was for you. I love you. Here I am. Let's do this." Sounds a little similar to another story that we're familiar with in the Bible, where the loving hero goes and he takes our place to accomplish what you and I could never accomplish. To come back and say, "Well, I was no good dead in the hole, but I came back so that I could love you and we could do this together and we would make music to God's ears, you and I. Let's do this. I'm here because I love you and I want this." And Aslan becomes the hero of this story. Aslan becomes the creator of this unconditional love, a relationship that just almost seems unheard of. It's hard to comprehend the beauty of such a relationship. And of course, there's the witch and her curses, her schemes, And then we see Susan and Lucy, the recipients of this relationship, this love exchange that Aslan delivers. And at the hands of the witch, Aslan comes and he makes an exchange. He goes in place of so that others wouldn't have to, gives his life, and he dies on the stone table. And on the same page, literally, where Aslan comes back to, he's dead and he comes back to life. Literally on the exact same page in the book, we see the very first response. We see the very first act, the very first move when he comes to life. And it's a moment of play. "Oh, children," said the lion, "I feel my strength coming back to me. Oh, children, catch me if you can." He stood for a second, his eyes very bright, his limbs quivering, lashing himself with his tail. And then he made a leap high over their heads and landed on the other side of the table, laughing, though she didn't know why. Lucy scrambled over it to reach him. Aslan leaped again. A mad chase began. Round and round the hilltop he led them, now hopelessly out of their reach, now letting them almost catch his tail, now diving between them, now tossing them in the air with his huge and beautifully velveted paws and catching them again, and now stopping unexpectedly so that all three of them rolled over together in a happy, laughing heap of fur and arms and legs. It was such a romp as no one had ever had except in Narnia. And whether it was more like playing with a thunderstorm or playing with the kitten, Lucy could never make up her mind. And the funny thing was that when all three finally lay together, panting in the sun, the girls no longer felt in the least tired or hungry or thirsty. Complete freedom, complete restoration, community, experienced through vulnerability, through joy and laughter, all found in a moment of play to celebrate and to worship the hero of the story. Quite possibly one of the books that's quoted most often in our gathering is a book by Eugene Peterson. It's called Christ Plays in 10,000 Places. And on the title of his book, he says this. Talking about the title of his book, he says, "Christ Plays in 10,000 Places is as good as a presentation of what we were after in understanding life. The end of life, as we are likely to find. The vigor and spontaneity. The God revealing Christ, getting us and everything around us in on it. The playful freedom and exuberance. The total rendering of our lives at play as worship before God." Would you bow your heads with me? If you journal in the gathering and you're in the middle of a thought, keep journaling, keep writing. This time is for you. If you're captivated in a thought or a piece of awareness, stay in it. Don't leave it. Continue to write, continue to reflect. And I simply want to give you a couple questions to take with you. And you can just meditate on these. You can write them down, whatever works for you. Some people would say it's difficult to enjoy God. It just is. I don't understand. It seems so complicated. It seems so ritual. It seems so serious. And it's hard to enjoy God. Is it quite possibly that our view of God is absent of play? And likewise, it can be hard to have a positive and exciting outlook on what heaven might be like. It's hard to get that glimpse of heaven. It's hard to get that glimpse of eternity. But again, is it possible that our view of heaven is absent of play? Is there a play deficit in your life? And if so, one simple question that I don't think I can answer. What would it be like to live life like a child again, but as a grown-up? What would it be like to take on the character of an innocent, humble, vulnerable child, and to take on what for them becomes the meaning of life, and to insert that into your story, your routine, your schedule, your rhythm? Might that view of heaven take on a beauty that it's never seen before? Might God become enjoyable? We've just created space for this to be a time of worship for you. And that we would worship in a way to where we would come together as a community of players. And that this would just merely be one expression of what it looks like to put a smile on God's face. And so here in this moment, on this occasion, on a Sunday, you could go and you could kneel down and you could pray at some spaces around the room. If that's how you want to worship and respond, you can go to the tables that are in the front or in the back. And you can take communion and you can remember, you can enjoy who God is through what he's given us of his son Jesus. There's places where you can give and let it be an act of worship. Let it be a moment of praise as you give joyfully, generously, and let this time be for you in response to a good God. Father, we love you. We thank you. We praise you. God, for some of us, this idea of play is so foreign. It's so confusing, or it just seems so wrong. In fact, it seems like a stretch. I just don't know if it's supposed to be that good. I don't know if it's supposed to be that fun. And for me, God, quite honestly, as I wrestle with this, as it stirs in my heart, my prayer so much is that these words would be true to who you are and how you've designed us. I'm choosing to believe that you designed us to play. And that by that play, we would worship you. It would be our act of being satisfied in you. And by it, God, would you be glorified. So God, move in us where it's difficult. Put people into our lives who play hard and love well by it. That we might experience the heart and the character of a child, and by it a glimpse of eternity, and by it a taste of heaven. So God, these songs we sing, these instruments that make noises for you, may they just be yet another expression of our play. We love you. In Jesus' name, amen.